OK, so I didn't put the word triviality in the title originally, because there's too many words, but also because it's kind of the ultimate insult for your calculation, right? It's the most pejorative term. It's trivial. You should have found it out immediately. And what I'm trying to say is, I've been saying this for a while, is that it's a subtle issue, but ultimately many things turn out to be trivial. And the vacuum instability and how it's used for a Higgs mass lower bound turns out to be a trivial issue. And I'm just trying to make the connection with things that have been done before in history. So part of what I'm going to talk about is historical. Part of it is maybe more recent and new. So at the very beginning, I just want to mention, you know, just what the experimental limits are on the Higgs mass. As Guillain said, there's no point trying to explain a fact. So in a sense, this is the fact, and the rest is the explanation. So again, you can make your own decision as to whether there's any information here. But at least I want to put that in context. But the part here is more general, which is a statement about how heavy or light a Higgs could the standard model have had with very weak constraints. And part of that story comes from what's called a Landau pole, which is essentially a divergence in a running Higgs coupling, which is translated into an upper bound for the Higgs mass. So that's how it's interpreted, and it's kind of a back of the envelope calculation. But the full story is more complicated, and actually it's going to be trivial, question of the triviality of a field theory. So up to this point, it's really just more or less history. After this, though, I want to talk about something else, which a person might naively say has no connection whatsoever with the Landau pole. And this is so-called vacuum instability in the Higgs potential, and how this is then translated into a Higgs lower bound. What I'm going to try to make is the connection that this is, in fact, not a real phenomenon, but that really a lower bound exists for the Higgs, which comes from the triviality of the theory again. So it's somehow in disguise. OK, so just the first part, just the experimental limits, just because, you know, that's what we know. So this curve was taken, I just took it this morning, actually, from the LEP Electroweak Working Group. I think this is their March update. So there's sort of a lot of information here. The yellow band is just the excluded region as regards the Higgs. So we haven't seen the Higgs, so it must be bigger than about 114 GeV. But we have measured many quantities. And so knowing that we have the standard model, we can use that model to fit the data, where the Higgs is now treated as a free parameter in the fit. And this curve here is sort of expressing the quality of that fit for different values of the Higgs mass. So this quantity del chi squared, it's just the difference from the actual value of chi squared to the minimum. So 0 here corresponds to the optimal fit, which is somewhere in the order of about 120, 130 GeV. And that's the black curve here, which goes out like this. Now, of course, there's an uncertainty. So really, it's the blue curve here. This band is the important part, because that's really sort of the one sigma range where the Higgs can be for, say, a given probability of how good the standard model is fitting the data. So all of the information here I just want to extract is that the standard model right now favors a light Higgs. The plus and minus errors are relatively large, because the dependence on the Higgs is not so strong. But certainly, it looks like something below 200, 250 GeV is what seems to be most likely. OK, so that's the fact.
Why are the errors so asymmetric? Chi squared looks like a nice
That I don't know.
Because it's almost everybody believes in some embellishment of the standard model, at least where I am. Doesn't this do away with all these bounds? I mean, there are little Higgs, there are Susie versions.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, there's about 20 standard models now.
OK, so. So the problem is then that if that was true, so then the standard model would not be a good fit to the data, right? So this is saying is that if the standard model is correct, there's a value of the Higgs mass for which all of the data is perfectly described.
Correct as what energy scale does the standard model have to be to make this a statement?
Okay, so no, what I can't really answer that question in detail. What I'm going to go to next is the question of what energy scale the standard model is a good theory for a different reason. But as far as I can see here, you're making an ansatz for what the behavior, say, of the W mass is as a function of the free parameters, one of which is the Higgs. The standard model has a prediction for that, which you then fit. A different model, let's say a little Higgs model, would have been different.
It should be translated into a statement of how high up you believe the standard model. Nobody thinks the standard model is going to be a Planck mass.
If this is true, so if you can fit your data to the actual ansatz, then in principle the theory is good to any energy scale, right?
If this is true up to one, if the minimal standard model is up to the order of one TeV,
then it would be that that nothing happens with our TV, you say.
Well, that. Yeah, it's not that sharp, but like, okay. So if you have supersymmetry, then the partners are separated by about one TeV in mass. In a way, if you have, now I don't know if you start doing something really very specific, you can push it. You know, this little Higgs models or something.
I mean, some people claim that.
10 TeV, yes.
Well,
so. But roughly, because there's a lot of measurement, and yes. You get screwed up if you had light or particles. Basic.
So this does not disprove the standard model, I would say.
So what are the three curves?
So these curves are for different values, this quantity, alpha hadronic at the 5-order loop. This blue curve here is really this one. That's the optimal value. So then you have two shifts depending on whether this is a particular experiment which is not a good fit. I think this is the W mass determined from the new type experiment. So this will shift the quality. It will favor a different value of the Higgs, but also maybe disimprove the overall level of the fit.
Because it's a change in the third significant digit that makes a shift on the logarithmic scale.
That some quantities are sensitive here and some are not. But I think just the overall picture is that there's nothing screaming out that the standard model is wrong at this point.
And the Higgs is light.
Yes, and that the Higgs is light.
That's the main message.
Okay, so now I go on to something more general, which is just omit the measurements, just be perverse, and just ask yourself as a theory, how heavy or light could the Higgs have been in the standard model with only a few pieces of information? And this plot is a representation of that. So this is taken from the Particle Data Group, 2002. And these two curves are meant to be upper and lower bounds for the Higgs mass as a function of some quantity capital lambda. And this is meant to be where the scale of new physics is coming in. So we interpret this as saying, well, the standard model is a good theory up to, say, 10 TeV, 100 TeV, 1,000 TeV, so on. Then the Higgs mass must lie within this range between the upper and lower curves. So there are two things you can extract from this. One is it tells you, of course, where the Higgs can be in the standard model, where you should be looking. So for instance, it appears that a Higgs as heavy as 1 TeV just doesn't work. So this area up here, for instance, just never lies anywhere within the bound, regardless of where the new physics scale is supposed to kick in. And in a way, that's kind of surprising, because if you imagine that the theory, the standard model, is good up to, say, the Planck scale, how would it be that it could care about a Higgs that is 1 TeV, that's so many orders of magnitude lighter? But yet the theory does care. It's constrained. And that such a light particle relative to the scale of new physics is, in fact, just not possible.
Is the bound to the lambda perturbative bound or a non-perturbative?
It's perturbative. Well, let's put it this way. It's a perturbative calculation of a divergence.
Exactly.
So now,
I mean, all you know is the perturbation theory isn't going to work there.
Right. So what I'm really doing is I'm setting this guy up in order to knock him down, and then I'm going to try to tell you whether or not there's something that can replace this. So this is sort of the more historical part, which a lot of people have done, and this is perhaps not as explored. So I'm just giving you the interpretation.
What did you say about this range?
So for instance, you could imagine that the standard model is good up to 10 to the Planck scale, and yet somehow a Higgs even bigger than 200 GeV just simply isn't possible in that theory. Which might seem strange.
What seems strange is that there is a scale which is so many orders of magnitude lower than that scale.
Yes.
That's really the strange.
That's fine.
That wipes out the other strange. What's you know, what is
okay.
Strange is that there is a naturalness problem. I mean, that's why we don't believe that this is true.
Okay, but I I'm not trying to defend this. But
the point is that just if you have a 10 to the 16, something must generate a scale which is, I don't know, 14 orders of magnitude smaller. The 247, forget about the Higgs mass. You know, just the Wien expectation value. That is, without the mechanism, it's very hard to believe that happens.
Right. Well, okay. Let me.
This is anti-natural.
Let me not.
Well,
it's not natural.
Fine. But that is a different statement. That's a statement about whether you believe about the normalization of the theory. This is actually just saying that a theory of this kind just does not generate such a heavy Higgs for any scale. But the other piece of information from these bounds, if you believe them, is that a positive measurement of a Higgs mass would tell you the standard model is valid up to only such a scale. So for instance, a Higgs which was here would then mean that the scale would be relatively light. A Higgs which would be in this narrow window means that the standard model could be valid up for a very large range of energies. And so that's maybe the more interesting piece of information. It's not necessary that the standard model breaks down then, but that's the ultimate point. You can't go further than that.
Can I ask just a mental historical question? But I've never understood, why do you care about a perturbative argument for the Lambda Poe?
How can I say it? I mean, that is how it is presented. I'm sorry.
Why did the community
care? Well, the history, I know a little bit of history. So it's Lambda and Pomeranchuk, they worked it out in QED, and they actually worked pretty hard playing around with extra diagrams and so forth, and for somehow, in some less Putin way.
No, but why do we have this curve shown to us for the last 15 years?
You asked a historical question. I think that's the history. So it
came he's from, a great guy.
Yeah. Well, it came from there. That's a, the round of forces in QED. But in the end, you know it's right.
What is curve? The theory becomes non-conservative.
What do you mean it works? That's what I understand.
It quantitatively gives agreements.
That's
what's going to come up next. So
this curve does have the interpretation that the theory becomes non-perturbative at that energy scale. So if you
precisely, that's all it tells you.
Right.
If you take off the standard model as being the perturbative theory, then perturbative theory fails. So there is new physics in that sense.
You would want to be aware of a prediction of non-perturbative behavior coming from perturbation theory. That's somehow an inherent contradiction.
It's a breakdown
of perturbation theory. Whether it's really okay, fine. Let me say no more than that. Okay, fine. Fine.
Like the existence of positronium is a breakdown of QED perturbation theory. Oh, great. What do we conclude from that? There's no positronium?
No, so the argument goes like that, this tells you that it's strongly interacting, and then you allow you
doesn't tell you that it's strongly interacting, it tells you it's non-perturbative.
Non-perturbative is strongly interacting, it's the same thing, it's a coupling constant being there.
Yeah. Let me continue, maybe things will get a little bit clearer. I think you actually agree. In both of these curves, there's a width that's shown, which is in principle a reducible error. We have a normalizable field theory, and so the question here about this width is a question of how much work that you're able to do in order to make these predictions. But in principle, these are predictions that can be made more precise. So I can almost skip this slide because that's exactly what we've been discussing. But that I just want to follow out the argument here. So we take a scalar field theory in four dimensions, and we have a running renormalized coupling. And I can set up my renormalization scheme such that at the VEV of the theory, the renormalized coupling is related to the Higgs and the VEV. That's a tree-level relation which I can maintain if I wish. Now, because the beta function of this theory is positive, then we're having an increasing renormalized coupling as you go to higher energy scales. So this is a cartoon of what's happening. I start at some initial value lambda 1 at this scale mu 1, which say I could choose to be the VEV. And at some scale, capital lambda, the running coupling will diverge. And that's interpreted now as being the breakdown of renormalized perturbation theory and non-perturbative physics is kicking in. Something new is happening at that point. Now this I can convert into an upper bound because I say, okay, let me fix this value here, capital lambda. So I want the standard model to be good up to this scale. Then my initial value of the running coupling cannot be larger than this. Otherwise the divergence would have occurred earlier. So this gives me an upper bound on this initial value of the running coupling lambda 1, which I can convert into an upper bound on the Higgs mass. Now, I'm simply telling the story as presented, not that I defend it. Now, of course, as Herbert pointed out, there's a full story there, and you can really do the work. So the real work is to be more honest about this field theory. So take the same field theory, which is defined in terms of some set of bare couplings and bare fields. Now regulate it and explore that theory. So I have, say, a lattice regulator, but it doesn't matter. For any regulator, I will have some phase diagram in the bare couplings. And this theory describes a Higgs phase and a symmetric phase. And that's just a question of which bare couplings you choose and where you want to be. This magenta curve here That's a critical surface which separates the two. It's critical because the two quantities I'm interested in, the Vedvatha theory and also the particle mass, they both vanish in that surface. So I'm simply taking the continuum limit by tuning myself to that point, where the correlation length becomes large and that is facing units. Of course, you might not necessarily have to go all the way to the continuum limit to say something that might be interesting. For instance, you might be quite close to this curve, say on this dashed line here, where the cutoff is finite but large. And at that point, the theory might be quite close to being physical, a physically acceptable theory. And the question was asked, this was asked by Herbert and Roger Dashen in 83, well then, the numerical experiment would be just to explore how close you can get to this critical surface and slightly off, and then just see what kind of a Higgs mass the system can generate dynamically. A really non-perturbative question, without falling back on a Landau-Pohl argument. And so a lot of people worked on this, and this is the conclusion, that it was actually a trivial theory. So the running coupling, say if I define it from the Higgs mass and the VeV, I find it vanishes very slowly. It goes logarithmically, but ultimately it will vanish. So the continuum limit of the theory describes a non-interacting theory. And it takes a long time to get there, but you know, you understand that it's actually already showing that behavior even when the cutoff is not so large. That's what the data points here are showing. So these data points, the horizontal line here is a measure of how far away you are from the critical surface, and I've chosen some large bare Higgs coupling. So the data points are sort of flat, but then they sort of fall into this 1/logarithm type falling into the origin here. So this is your situation. You found that the continuum theory seems to be non-interacting, so now you have to choose your poison. Do you want that non-interacting theory, or do you accept an interacting theory with a finite cutoff and some finite cutoff effects? Just to give you an idea of the scales here, the quantity x here, 0.1, sort of the far right of this, that corresponds to a cutoff which is about 8 times the VeV, if I use a pi over a, the lattice spacing, the largest momentum in the lattice, and the Higgs VeV ratio there is a bit less than 3. Now, it really was non-perturbative in that it was found that the largest Higgs you could generate in the system for a fixed cutoff was when the bare coupling diverged. But even in that limit, there was an enormous renormalization because the renormalized coupling was actually relatively small and finite. But you couldn't have known that without doing the simulation. That's simply information that we can access. But the other piece is that the cutoff doesn't actually need to be that large in order to be quite close to a continuum theory. So if I use, say, the correlation length of the system as a measure of how far I am from the continuum, then even when the correlation length is only in the order of about 2 lattice spacings, the violation of Euclidean invariance is relatively small, somewhere in the order of a few percent, which is maybe a little bit surprising. Now, as you push the correlation length larger, then that violation of Euclidean invariance very quickly essentially becomes negligible. So you have a control, or you have some sense of how large the cutoff effects are, and from the simulation you have an idea of how heavy a Higgs you can generate. So then you can convert that information hopefully into something physics interesting. So that gave me an upper bound, or gave the community an upper bound, which for a cutoff which was relatively light meant that I couldn't really generate a Higgs which is bigger than this range, say somewhere between 600 and 700 GeV. If I pushed the cutoff very high, say to Planck scale, then there was sort of a factor of 4 difference in how heavy a Higgs I could have. The system was forced to be much lighter. Now, when I put in 600 to 700 here, you might think, well, you know, there was uncertainties, and maybe this was done some number of years ago, it wasn't a good calculation, blah, blah, blah. But actually what's reflected here is that there's a regulator dependence on this prediction. I can define this cutoff in many ways, many different lattice actions, and I'll find a different bound for each one of these. And there will be some variation with that regulator dependence because it's not a universal quantity. So this is not a question of statistics, it's a question of the setup of the behavior of the theory. And there were a host of people, some of them even here, who worked on this problem over the last, say, 15 years.
Is that consistent with the earlier statement of the CEV for the bound on the...
You want to go back to the previous plot? So this is maybe you would say, the sad part.
No, I want to go back.
So,
he wants the chi-square plot, which gives you the space.
Okay, so you're saying that with TEV new physics, that's what a cutoff is. What was it, less than 600?
600 to 700. So it's off here.
So it's excluded by many chi-square.
No, as I understand, he's now got new physics at a TEP.
No, I'm saying that the Higgs cannot be heavier than 600, 700 GeV if new physics, if the cutoff of the theory is a few TeV.
Right, and this says that
that's consistent.
Where is it?
Yes, but this is saying more. This is giving more information. This is taking actual experimental observations and fitting them. I've used very little information to extract my upper bound. Exactly.
Do you know what? This graph comes from, this plot comes from something, in particular delta rho. There is a quantity which has a contribution from a Higgs group, which is a long MH. Yeah. And you measure it and you calculate. And from that you get the log of MH. And it's, as you see, it's not very accurate because it's the log of MH that comes in.
It's in the right.
Also correct. But
it's much tighter.
But yeah. So they come in logarithmic.
Yeah, but it's giving a much tighter bound than
exactly, because I'm using less information.
Right. So this basically tells you that you shouldn't worry that much about what would, whether it's possible not to have that Higgs. So.
But the statement was, it was interesting, the fact that the non-perturbative simulations, I don't know if I want to say unfortunately, but they somehow corroborated this perturbative argument.
Well, a question. The simulation is on the just phi-4 model or the gauge phi-4 model?
It was the O4 model. Okay. So the O4 lambda phi-4 was the one that was ultimately done.
Right, but because the gauged one doesn't have the second order phase transition.
Absolutely. Mm. It is just because G squared is, you know, all the gauge couplings are small, so in particular, you can neglect them if the Higgs is heavy.
Right.
So, but that doesn't have to, this doesn't, that stuff doesn't tell you anything about the Higgs when it's light. When it's light, you do this perfect. You get ordinary continuity theory within any reason.
The question is, how light? And now that's the new part. So up to now, this has essentially been retelling of history and telling other people's work. So now again, I'm going to backtrack and tell you where that lower bound came from in that plot from the particle data group. I'll explain as best I can. So I'll just take a simpler model first, which is scalars coupled to fermions. And I have, say, NF degenerate fermions in my system. Just makes life easier for me. So if I calculate the Higgs effective potential, then at one loop, I have all these diagrams that I have to sum. So the dashed lines are the scalars, and the solid lines are the fermions. And there are infinitely many of these one-loop diagrams that I have to sum up. But that's fine, I know how to do that. You'll find that there will be an integrand, which is logarithmic. That's just sort of a resummation of all those diagrams. So the effective potential, then, is given by the tree level potential here, V. Then this is the contribution from all of the Higgs loops. And this is the contribution from all of the fermion loops, which come with their NF, and also a minus sign because they're fermion loops. So now you would say, well, this is just perturbation theory. Just do the normal thing. You regulate this, add counter terms to observe the divergences, and then you remove the cutoff. And you'll get this maybe a little bit complicated looking form for the effective potential. There will now be logarithms in derivatives, say, of the scalar of the potential here, V, and logarithms here also in phi. So this is also logarithm of phi squared. You still have this minus sign between the Higgs terms and the top terms, let me call them that. And this minus sign is what's going to cause the issue here. Because if this fermion term here was going to dominate at large values of the scalar field, which is a constraint on how these couplings relate to each other, then it looks like the potential is unstable. It actually runs off to minus infinity at large values of phi. So the point of the potential was to produce a non-zero minimum, but we want that minimum to be an absolute minimum, not just a local minimum. So it looks like we may have to worry about how light the Higgs is relative to, say, the top Yukawa coupling. Otherwise, our vacuum is unstable. Now, this is better than the Landau pole because this does not necessarily have to be a non-perturbative argument. This relationship between the couplings can be satisfied even though the couplings themselves might be small. So on the surface, this looks like it's more kosher. It was Linde and Creve in 75, I think, who were maybe the first to point this out. And it's been improved over the years. And a lot of people, I'm only naming a few of them here, have been involved with this. A lot of these people have gone on to very good things since then. And so this is not sort of a little corner of the standard model. This has actually been rather much pursued as being an interesting question. So the most recent version of it is in the standard model calculation is to do this two loops. Now, there are logarithms of the scalar field phi appearing, so you have to worry about the effect of those potentially large logarithms. RG improvement is done in order to cure that problem, so people are aware of that, that you might be careful about your perturbation theory, how it's breaking down. So the plot that I'm showing here is the effective potential for given values of these parameters. So the top quark here is fixed to 175 GeV and the Higgs to 52. And so I'm plotting the effective potential, which is this solid curve here, as a function of the scalar field phi. So what appears to happen is that I have my normal electroweak ground state here, about 250 GeV, and that's fine. But eventually the effective potential sort of turns around, goes off to minus infinity. And that happens somewhere when phi is about 1 TeV.
Can perturbation be trusted when phi is 1 TeV? And perturbation theory is a small oscillation expansion.
So you're saying this looks like a large correction relative to the tree level?
Yeah, that's what perturbation theory is about. It's small oscillations. How do I just trust perturbation theory when phi gets big?
No, I think in this...
You have to take... I know it's the times the coupling constant, but is that really...
The danger is people would argue if this correction is coming from a large logarithm, then the RG improvement is going to take care of that. What I'm actually going to argue is that it's really, you can translate all of this behavior, the effective potential, into the running of the Higgs coupling. Where there it looks safer, because then it's essentially the Higgs coupling becoming negative, which could be a safe perturbative argument in that entire range that you're running. So the effective potential maybe is a prettier picture, but in practice, it's actually the beta function of the Higgs coupling that's used to extract where this lower bound is coming from.
But maybe you can explain the physical reason why it comes so. I mean, why do fermions do that? There's a physical, simple reason.
I'm going to just say because of the sign that appears as a contribution to the effective potential.
Yeah,
but if you want to make something like that the ground state is now different because the system is rearranged.
No, they like to open a gap, because if you open a gap, you gain energy, right? If you open a gap in the IC, the bigger you make the gap, the more energy you gain, right? Because you have to fill the C and you don't have to go all the way up. You go less up. So because the physicality of the argument, you believe it, when it makes perfect sense.
So if this is the effective potential, then the theory is
right. So now you have to. I'll try to put the information together.
Right.
So for this particular choice of Higgs mass, you would say the theory is sick at the 1 TeV scale. Something else must come in, otherwise this potential, this local minimum is only local. It's not the absolute minimum of the theory. Right. So now I would say, okay, if I want my theory to be good up to 1 TeV, but not beyond, this is the lightest Higgs that I can allow in that theory. If the Higgs was heavier than 52, then this instability would be pushed out further to the right. It would only occur at a higher energy scale.
What you are doing is putting a cut in the quantum field. Would you say 2 pi?
Again, let me try to emphasize, this is not what I believe. I'm just putting forward the picture of what other people interpret this as saying. They are saying that the effective potential, if it really has this behavior, there must be something new happening here, otherwise this is not our vacuum. We will tunnel out of it.
I think the question was whether your integral of phi, whether phi is in the integral, an absolute value, is restricted below lambda. The answer is no, I think. I mean, in the standard thing, but I think that was your question.
Okay. But what I'm trying to turn the information around is that when I look at a potential of this form, how do I extract information and then call it a lower bound on the Higgs? So if my potential always has this form, then it's a question of where does this instability occur? Does it occur at very large values of the field phi or relatively light? And that will turn into a constraint on how light the Higgs can be. So in this particular case, the Higgs can be 52 GeV, but not lighter. Otherwise, the instability would have occurred at a smaller scale. And I can also get that information from the running of the Higgs coupling, because If the top is dominating the Higgs self interaction, that should be a square here, or that should be a square here, then the beta function for the Higgs is negative. So when I look at the running Higgs coupling, it's actually going to eventually become negative, it's going to run out to negative value here. So I can use the instability and the potential error in the running Higgs coupling that I can translate between those two. So now this is what I get from those bounds. These are just two different views of the scale. I just want to show here that there's sort of a pretty strong sensitivity on the value of the top quark mass. So things can move around quite a bit. Here the scale of new physics is put between 1 and 10 TeV. And this is just the previous plot from before, just showing it again, because you see that the stability, the lower bound here is rather steep for low energy scales, but then sort of flattens out. And which is why that there's a sort of this narrow window for the Higgs could be, and everything would be fine. The uncertainty of the lower bound is estimated to be about 5 GeV, which of course can be made more accurate if you can do enough work. And the lower bound is where things are interesting today, because of the Higgs being light.
Is there a reason why the upper bound and the lower bound always need a window between them? Couldn't this window close?
So I think if you go far enough, then they will eventually close. That's right. But
that's called the Planck chimney.
These are both monotonic functions, I think.
If you increase the left, just mathematically, don't you move more the lower than the upper one?
You mean if I take the... I can...
If you artificially increase the number of...
Sure. Then this moves up.
Move up.
That's right.
Faster than the lower one. So I think you can realize a model with, I mean, a mathematical model for...
For these were intersect at lower scale?
I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea. I'm asking. I mean, you have it in your head that what happens when you change a value.
If you change NF, if you increase NF, the lower bound will increase. I cannot say for the upper bound.
Right. Also, the upper bound will move a little bit. Right? I mean, it's...
Do you think the principle, at least predictably, what happens is that when you follow the running of the bound, it becomes negative in the vacuum instability range and infinite in the Landau plot. So therefore,
that's
it
right.
Always be positive infinite.
So it's there's always a window.
There's a delicate window where you can just tune to be zero.
That has to become positive before the
divergence. Okay, so that's where the instability comes from. So the question is it really unstable? Is that actually true? And so let me just set up what you can do. You don't have to just do perturbative calculations. You can calculate the effective potential non-perturbatively. A nice quantity to look at is actually the constraint effective potential. So if you're working in a finite volume, then you constrain the average of the field to be some fixed value capital phi. And then you allow fluctuations around that average. So that's a delta function that you insert into your path integral. And then you simply just run your simulations as before. And you repeat this for different values of large capital phi. Then it turns out that constraint potential actually has an absolute minimum, even in finite volume. So the properties of an effective potential as regards convexity, they do not apply in this particular case, which is very nice because this will be a clear order parameter to allow you to distinguish between the Higgs and the symmetric phases. It was O'Rafferty and these people who worked on showing that the constraint potential had this nice property. So again, the day after St. Patrick's Day, it's nice to refer to an Irish physicist with the hardest to spell name.
There is a distinction between Higgs and symmetric, even if you know it's upper. You don't need constraint effective potential.
If I was to calculate the effective potential, just the straight effective potential, I should really see that the potential is flat between the two minima. There's a convexity.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a Maxwell construction,
yeah,
which is not required for the constraint potential.
The constraint potential comes to answer a technical problem which has to do with the fact that you simulate in a finite volume.
Yes.
But clear distinction between Higgs and symmetric occurs at infinite volume, mm-hmm, and has nothing to do with constraint or not constraint. Just what
the constraint potential and the ordinary potential agree in the infinite volume image. That is correct. But I'm just saying that this is a nice property in finite volume. Because if
it's just a logical sequence there which is wrong.
Okay.
There's a clear distinction between symmetric. We have a problem maybe in a finite volume. I disagree actually that this is the right
thing. There's a clear distinction between Higgs and symmetric phases in a finite volume.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
In finite volume.
Yeah. Just dot dot dot. Didn't fit on that line.
Oh.
It is
with clear distinction, you mean that, they are separate phases?
There is no clear.
I can.
That statement would be just wrong. The phases. No, but the constraint effective potential can have a double hand without, in the infinite volume limit, that's the same having a because I have finite volume effects now. So it could look like that in spite of the fact that when you, it's still symmetric because of all the one over omega effects. Mm-hmm. So the reason, then the clear has to be wrong.
Okay. So measure the potential. So measure the potential in your favorite model. So I take the Higgs-Yukawa model again. This is a single scalar. There's some number of degenerate fermions. This is really just saying I have some copies of staggered fermions. I do that because with the fluctuating scalar field, I cannot guarantee positivity of the determinant unless I have two copies. So this is something I have to be aware of. So what I actually measure is I measure the derivative of the constraint effective potential, which is given in terms of some number of expectation values. So these expectation values are calculated when the background field, so the field is fixed at some average value with fluctuations around it, and then I repeat these measurements at different values of capital phi. So these two curves are the same potential, this one is zooming in around the origin of the other. And these black dots, if you can see them, those are the results of the simulation. So here, 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 so on. Also this other plot out here. So the derivative of the potential, it vanishes at the origin, then it vanishes out somewhere around here, it's value about, say, 3.1. It's negative in between, then it's positive ever after. So this is telling me that the origin is a local max, and that this point out here is the absolute minimum. So this is telling me that I'm in the Higgs phase of the theory. So this is for some particular choice of Baire couplings. But there is no sign that anything strange is happening at large values of the scalar field on this plot over here. In fact, it just seems to increase ever more as I go to larger values. So the question is, where is the instability? The instability appears in this model, because after all, it's coupled to fermions.
How did you do the simulation?
It's a standard simulation. So let's say I can use HMC with a constraint. So this is going to be a constraint which is imposed as I...
You did HMC.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at each step when you update that file, you just need...
There's an average constraint which you must hold. So you're just allowing the fluctuations, but you maintain the average. The average must be held fixed. So, and the fluctuations can be as large as they want to be. That's up to the system to do.
You didn't do FFTs back and forth. So.
No, didn't do this. So the question is, where is the instability? And also, what are those other two curves that I've drawn there?
And how big did you do?
These are relatively small. I think these are 12 to the 4 lattices. Not particularly big. So I want to compare my simulations with something, so I'm going to compare to perturbation theory. So this first line is what I just wrote down for the effective potential when I have this infinite set of one-loop diagrams. So now I'm going to say, okay, let's try to regulate this theory and absorb the divergences. And I'm going to keep this regulator here present in my integrals for the moment. So when I expand the logarithm here, there are two terms. So I get a first term here, which is going to lead to a quadratic divergence. The second term here, which is going to lead to a logarithmic divergence. So these are the two counter terms that I add into my system to exactly cancel those two divergences. Those are simply the counter terms that I've added. And this one involves some scale mu, which is going to play the role of the RG scale, ultimately. So these are the counter terms that come from the Higgs loops, and these are the counter terms that come from expanding this and seeing the divergence in the fermion loops. So now, the question is whether or not you're going to try to send this regulator to infinity. So if I keep that regulator finite, I'll actually find that this renormalized perturbation theory, because it's going to be renormalized couplings as a function of some RG scale, will be in perfect agreement with the simulations. But if I, in some sense, naively try to remove that regulator in a standard fashion, I'll find the effective potential which has this strange turning around and becoming unstable behavior. So that those are the two curves which I showed here previously. So this pink curve is the renormalized perturbation theory where the cutoff is always kept present. And you see it follows the data points just basically bang on.
And how do I know No, phi is actually dimensional, so where is the time?
Yeah, yeah, so this is everything is in cutoff units. So this is really, so now it's really, it's a lattice theory. So the perturbation theory I do will ultimately be a lattice perturbation theory.
So when I see a phi of 5, that means that
it's large relative to the cutoff. So the cutoff is, say, 1 in these units, if you like.
So that's well, you would say that you would not believe in that. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. But what's interesting is that maybe then you have to be a bit careful about what the choice of couplings were that gave this particular situation. But the normalized perturbation theory, as you said, it agrees perfectly with the simulations and the other perturbation theory for small values of phi. And for large values of phi, then that's when it breaks down. So sure, it actually works maybe for even slightly larger values of phi than you might have expected. But I'm just trying to show that this dashed curve doesn't know about cutoff anymore.
That was the argument in the first place, right? When this happens, you're not trusting it anymore. That was the initial argument. So that's exactly what happens.
Yeah. No.
Sorry, you said that phi was plotted in units to the cutoff. But what
yes.
does that mean for the dashed curve where there's no cutoff?
So, okay. So in this, I have to define, okay, right, I think that's right. So what you're doing is you're going to eventually have to express things in terms of phi over mu. That's what's going to happen. So in this curve, for the dash one, I'm actually going to have logarithms of phi over mu. And mu is going to be a choice also in cutoff units. Not answering the question.
So what happens if you make the cutoff 10 times higher in
the
perturbation theory with a lattice cutoff, you should be able to calculate the solid curve also for that cutoff, and does it turn down?
So what I can do, so the minimum here, so how do I know what my cutoff is? If the minimum of the effective potential is at a value of about 3, that's the VEV of the theory. So now this is telling me that I'm really, in a sense, deep in the cutoff. So if I tune my couplings such that this is much smaller, right, then what happens is that the divergence will occur here. It's probably going to be pushed into this. So the agreement will, you are, as you change the cutoff, where this disagreement occurs will also change. I don't want to say something that's not correct.
Did you make the cutoff, let's say 20?
No, it's not. It's have to be careful because the cutoff is in a sense fixed here on this plot. I'm changing the scale by changing where the VEV is.
Okay, yeah, I'll make.
So the cutoff in a sense will always be at 1.
The units.
The cutoff in units of the VEV.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Keep
and that's
fixed. Okay, first, and you make a plot. Then you change the cutoff in the units of that. So then one line should move and the other should, right? Because one line is in the dealing with the cutoff is infinite.
Right, that's correct. That's right.
That's right. So it would be nice to see how.
Okay, I don't have that. And I don't want you to say what it is and say something incorrectly.
But basically, you would say that when the magenta line changes significantly, then there it's cutoff.
That's where you're sensitive to the cutoff. That is correct.
And do you know where it is?
No, I can't say. This is just a. All I wanted to show from this example was just to show where the continuum perturbation theory is working perfectly well and where it doesn't. And that the instability, what looks like an instability, is where the cutoff effects become significant, I think.
I don't know
if I agree with what Ova says at that point.
What do you mean continuum perturbation? Do you mean just expanding around the Gauss shell? That's good also if there is a cutoff.
No.
Sometimes.
What I mean is that when I, let me go back to a previous expression. This expression here. So what I'm trying to do is use this expression.
Expanding around the Gauss.
That's right.
So that's something you can do with a cutoff or without the cutoff. By continuous perturbation, we mean that we eliminate the cutoff.
Right. So this is an expression where the cutoff has been eliminated, and I'm comparing that to one where the cutoff has not been eliminated. That was the comparison of the magenta and the dash curves.
Right.
So
okay.
I think we
But I mean, eventually, if you put the cutoff in the lattice extremely high, wouldn't you eventually expect a disagreement between the lattice perturbation theory with that cutoff and the lattice simulation?
Okay, so I have to be careful about the. If I make the cutoff, if I push myself very close to the continuum limit, maybe then the perturbation theory will have problems, the bare perturbation theory.
Well, if that's not the case, then I don't understand what this perturbation theory means at all. I mean, you're saying that when the cutoff is infinite, there's a huge discrepancy. You didn't see that progressively as you put the cutoff to infinity, then I wouldn't understand what you meant by that continuum perturbation theory.
Let me try to make the statement, and maybe just a question of the way I'm presenting this. One sees an instability in a continuum potential. I'm trying to explain that what we see is really that there are large cutoff effects which are important here. The true potential is not unstable. So.
But this is the true potential on the lattice.
Yes. So now you have to say what does that mean? If the cutoff is large.
I mean, we're after whether, when I look at the curve of phi, or at least phi equals 10, whether all I'm seeing is some lattice model. Of course, you wrote a lattice integral which exists, it will exist. Always.
Yeah, that's right.
So I mean, it will not crap out. I mean, it exists.
Yeah, so there's no instability, period. No matter how
But then, but no surprise either.
I know, but I, so what's
so, so I'm trying to say that there is no instability. I'm trying to say that there is no instability.
No, but you're saying it's no instability and that there is, and it is a surprise, right?
No, I'm not surprised that there is an instability. I'm trying to argue why the calculation of those who show that there is an instability is not valid at a certain point.
No,
that's what I'm asking.
No.
And you say
ever claimed that be valid beyond that point, and I did not have the impression.
So let me go back to this. The calculation here is saying that this is not because of a difficulty in the calculation, it's because the theory is now broken down for the reason that there are new degrees of freedom which have to be included. Okay. In order to rescue this potential from being unstable.
So let me see. So you're correcting a statement that may be found sometimes in the continuum literature, which says the vacuum phi will acquire a huge expectation, and saying that's not true. They should have said is, at that point, we're sensitive to cutoff limits. That's what you're saying.
That's the careful statement, yes.
Okay.
What I want to say is but they would say that they can make an arbitrarily precise prediction of that, and that they could really tell where the new physics would be if they knew what the Higgs mass would be. That they can make that lower bound precise. And I want to somewhat destroy that.
So you claim. Want to say that there is no precise meaning to that one?
I think yes. That it's not a regulator independent statement.
But if you look at the plot that you had, and let's say you fix, I find it easier to think in terms of GeV, so let's fix our units so that phi is 3.0, so that is
3.1,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Make the cutoff higher and higher. Eventually, the magenta line should agree with the dust line to higher and higher phi, so you should get another minimum. Sure, it would probably still go up even when phi becomes greater than the cutoff. But you would have another minimum where you would be sensitive to the cutoff. So there's two minima. There's the sort of continuum one, it's a small phi, and then there is the
So you're arguing that the true potential has a behavior like this. Starts at the origin, goes down, increases, goes down, and eventually will shoot up like this?
Can you tell
us? Oh, sorry.
Right, and if you don't see that on the lattice, then I wouldn't say there's any instability.
Yes.
Right. So you haven't yet seen the instability that you're claiming may be there.
I don't know. I'm not claiming the instability exists.
At present, what you're saying is that the perturbation theory is completely unreliable because you have not been able to reduce the instability on the lattice.
Look, it's hard to build it. So you're saying that actually this line, just the fact that it goes back down, that even that statement is never in the form, maybe for very light Higgs, no, maybe not 50, but even much lighter, will never be realizable in a way which is insensitive to the pattern.
That's what we're trying to show.
That's
what we're trying to show.
Okay, so let's repeat the claim, because the claim now becomes sort of.
So I'm claiming that the instability is not a real thing.
Yeah, so let's be precise. So when I paint this curve, and I just put the line after it comes back down, just a little
right, so here?
Dash. Yes. So I would have thought that if I make an image light enough, there is actually a almost kind of independent statement for some parameter that just happens.
That the other minimum radius does appear.
So the figure from the beginning up to that line that we drew is actually correct. And you're saying it will never be correct.
No.
In a kind of independent way.
I'm saying that this feature, that this appears.
No, forget about that.
But that's the important part. That's the important part. Otherwise.
I draw the dashed line so that it goes below the other one. That's all I want.
Yeah, okay.
I don't care about where it goes.
Okay, sure.
But that make it the dashed line a little bit to the right so it's below the other.
Okay, sure. So you want to be like this.
Okay. I would believe that there are parameters for which this is the output comes out from a continuum calculation, and I can realize it on the lattice.
Right. If you can't, then it's commodified perversion.
This is so clear. Fermions just like to dig the hole in because.
Well, but just begin. Therefore, we should be able to write the principle. Very
hard. Yeah. So
take
I
the lattice cutoff to be
whatever, and get this.
Million GeV.
Yeah.
And then if you don't get that, it ain't there. It's an artifact of your perturbation expansion. You're a mistake.
And I'm trying to argue that that's what we see. I have not proven it, but I'm arguing that that's.
It's very hard to
far out. Then you want to make it big enough and so on. But the point is, you never have to take the cutoff to infinity to see whether this is physics. You claim it as an instability when phi is a border GeV. And if you take the lattice cutoff much bigger than that, you don't see it, it's not clear. That's
all I'm saying is that intuitively I feel that very plausible that it's going to happen.
Well, but he's saying there's no evidence. He's saying the opposite. He's saying that.
Yeah, he's saying that.
Yeah. And that therefore.
But we don't have the numbers, right?
That's right.
I mean, to see how.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you have basically a choice between whether you believe that at some point perturbation theory is just wrong. Or that the continuum limit doesn't exist.
No, it's more than perturbation theory wrong. Perturbation theory is totally wrong
without
giving by itself an indication that it went wrong.
Yeah.
That has never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, except we really missed something. It could be that we missed a mechanism, I don't know, there's some condensation of fermions that we forgot about or some other mechanism that happened.
Saying if the Higgs mass is very light, then this turnover will occur well within the perturbation.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I think, not me, I think that's what Lindell was
saying. No, I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you say that is not true, then then you should put your finger on why it's
very
true.
I think if I look at this form, I would have to look at the renormalized potential and see how many relevant parameters it has in order to produce this behavior. In order to produce, say, more than one minimum, then I would imagine that there would be something like an extra relevant parameter that has to appear in the effective potential in order to produce that second minimum, beyond just the mass and the coupling.
Is mass coupling or you coupling?
Right, but beyond that, whether or not that this other potential can appear.
Don't mean to have a minimum.
Okay, fine. That just comes down.
Below the first minimum. I mean, the perhaps a minimum is just a cutoff effect.
Right. But until it turns down below to the there, only these parameters that So, the physics is very simple. I mean, it's just that fermions like to make a hole because then they have to fill up, did it up, see to a lower level and to gain energy by that. So it pays for the fermion to make a phi have an expectation. Right? And then there is a penalty coming from the potential of the phi, which says, I don't want to make phi large. But that penalty you reduce by making lambda very small, which is making the lambda very small. So eventually it looks to me that these two conflicting desires can all be kept within the perturbation theory. So
okay.
That's why I have difficulty.
Okay. Not proven. Not proven.
Oh.
No.
Yes.
Not conclusive evidence, you feel.
I'm open. Just if you give me some numbers or something that I understood why, or some understanding why. What's wrong with what I'm saying, basically, I want to know. And what's the evidence that it's wrong?
Maybe if I try to go to the running of the couplings, because as I said before, the effective potential is one way to see this instability, but the running of the Higgs coupling is another. And if I see a failure in the RG treatment of that running coupling, then that would be another way of seeing that I see that the fact that the cutoff is having an effect at some point. Maybe that's even a better way. Let me try to explain what I mean. So start with the original Bayer theory in terms of the Bayer parameters. And this is, I know it's a bit of a painful plot, but I just want to be somewhat detailed. I want to make the connection between the Bayer parameters, the Bayer parameters and their normalized parameters. So this would be sort of textbook perturbation theory. So I introduce the wave function normalization factors, and then I introduce the renormalized and the counter terms, which are going to absorb the divergences. Now, okay, up to this point, it's just been sort of definitions, but now I'm going to take the large and F limit in order to make the situation somewhat simpler for myself. In that particular case, the Fermi loops are the only things that contribute. So the wave function normalization for the fermion is 1. So now I have these relationships between the Bayer and the renormalized parameters, so these three equations here. And the counter terms I find are this term, which is quadratic, this term, which is logarithmic, and then because of the large NF limit, there will be no counter term for the Yukawa coupling. So now I fix my Bayer couplings. So I'm sitting somewhere in the phase diagram at a physical point, so that the masses are fixed. And I want to adjust my scale mu, which is appearing in these counter terms, and the renormalized parameters also adjust in order to keep that theory physically the same. That is the RG. So what do I see? And again, I denote whether or not I keep the cutoff finite in these expressions.
What do you do with y when you take an F-band benefit? Don't you have to rescale y?
Right, so these are, I would say these would be the rescale parameters. You have to actually, you will actually show the rescale parameters.
But I saw them, I should see no NFs in the formula.
Well, NF appears here, but to be careful about the NF limit, you have to be careful about the scaling of the parameters. That is right.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. So now pick just some values for the Bayer couplings. So I'm somewhere in the physical parameter space. And now I just adjust the scale, or the RG scale mu, and I see how the renormalized couplings must adjust in order to match everything. And so the yellow line, or the pink lines again here, are there. That's what happens when I keep the cutoff finite in those Bayer counter terms. And the dashed line is just when I imagine that I've taken that cutoff to infinity. Now the RG flow is identical for when the scale mu, which again, unfortunately, it's in lattice spacing units, is much less than 1, which is where everything should work fine. But then the RG in the continuum is breaking down when mu is getting an order of 1, which is what we would say is perfectly natural. We don't expect the continuum RG to be correct at that point. The running Higgs coupling eventually goes down and will eventually become negative and looks like it's an instability, whereas the actual RG coupling must flow, in fact, to the Bayer coupling. That's what we find here. You can see that from the view of the construction of the counter terms. So from the lattice point of view, there's just a region where continuum RG is working well and where it does not. And where it does not is where cutoff effects have become important in the RG, and so the instability is not a real prediction. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh yeah, so what you're actually saying is that you can never reach this, you can't move this vertical line so far to the right, because there are no such Bayer couplings. There are no Bayer couplings that would...
There are no Bayer couplings that would achieve that. So look at this value. So what's the best you can do? So what's the best? How can I make the agreement in some sense best?
I don't understand the statement. Are we have a choice number 0.0.1?
This is just a choice for. So in the previous line equations here, I have to make some choice for the Bayer couplings. So that's an arbitrary choice. It's not important what it is. I mean, for a continuum theory, that's not an arbitrary choice. But just for the pedagogy, it is. And now the normalized couplings m squared, lambda y, and z phi. They must run with the RG scale in order to maintain these equations. That's all.
Yeah, no, but so the picture would look that I'm missing something. So the if I want now to see the picture for lambda 0 equals 10 to the minus 5.
Right, exactly. So now this plateau will move down closer to the origin. And so then it really is, the disagreement's already starting here at about 0.1. So then it's going to be perhaps that they agree over a slightly larger range, because this is going to become negative when mu is just slightly above 1, say, or close to 1. Where this value is going to plateau, it's just that fraction, the epsilon above 0. So that's where my bound is going to come from ultimately. It's going to come from the smallest lambda 0 that I'm allowed to have, which is going to be this epsilon above 0. But what the point of this plot is to show that it's the breakdown in the RG, in the continuum RG, that's giving the fake instability.
What's the interpretation of the plateau?
The plateau is what the RG should be doing. The renormalized couplings should flow to the bare couplings. That's what I see here. So take, for instance, this relationship between bare and renormalized couplings. If mu becomes much larger than 1, then the effect of this counterterm is to go to 0. The wave function normalization factor will also go to 1 in that limit. I haven't written the explicit expression. So the bare coupling lambda must flow to the renormalized coupling lambda must flow to the bare one in the limit where mu becomes much less greater than 1. So the lattice RG is working fine. It's a question of whether the continuum RG is doing a good job or not.
Stabilize exactly where you told it would.
Yes. Yes.
There's not a universal. Yeah.
That's true. Let me think about that. I don't want to just answer immediately. I haven't thought about that. Okay, so it's 12:05. How much later should I go? I mean, is there another talk?
How much more do you mean?
I think in the order of between 5 and 10 minutes.
5 minutes will be fine.
All right, I'll speak twice as quickly. So the statement we would say is that if you're going to explore a lower bound for the Higgs, and I don't believe that the instability is real, where am I going to extract it from? I'm going to extract it from a similar numerical experiment as the upper bound. I'm going to adjust my bare couplings to have some finite large cutoff, and then just see what is the lightest Higgs I can generate with some number of constraints. For instance, a constraint on what the top quark mass is. So the simulations we did were again for this toy model with many degenerate fermions. And this plot here is a summary of the simulations. So the curves here are for a fixed cutoff in physical units. For physical units, that just means the cutoff to VeV ratio is fixed, and then physical, I guess, call the VeV 250 GeV. So for instance, this green curve here is when the cutoff is, say, 1.5 TeV. So I'm varying my bare couplings in order to vary the top quark mass. Then along these curves are where I found the limit, and the limit is where my bare coupling here vanishes. Because for every fixed cutoff, that's the smallest Higgs that my system can generate. You can't go below that point. And that's quite nice and symmetric relative to the upper bound, which occurs when the bare coupling diverges. So 0 to infinity really is your limit of bare couplings, and that gives you the upper and lower bound for the Higgs mass. You keep track of your cutoff effects by, say, keeping track of the correlation length and lattice spacing units. So if I make an arbitrary choice here that this has to be bigger than 2 lattice spacings, that gives me this dashed curve here. And where you want it to be is on the left-hand side of that. So now how would I extract from this a cutoff, a lower bound? Well, I would say, you tell me what top quark you want to have. That would be some vertical line here. Then each of these curves is the minimal one for a given cutoff. So as this vertical line crosses each of these, that gives me the lightest Higgs as a function of the cutoff. And that's what I've plotted here in this next one here. Again, with some physical units put in just by hand to make it more interesting, maybe. So just units of lattice spacing. So you can make the Higgs as light as this for that given cutoff and for this top quark, but not lighter. So that's sort of the way in which one would extract some information on the lower bound. But, and the caveat is that there's an ambiguity in that statement, as I said before, about a regulator dependence. So let me take again, go back to the previous large NF limit of the Higgs-Yukawa model, where I can make perturbation theory exact. I could have used different regulators. That was my choice. And what I want to compute is a lower bound with different regulators and see how much variation there is. So this plot is a lower bound for some fixed top quark mass. And I've used three regulators, hard momentum, the lattice, and then one where the propagators are replaced by a higher derivative term. And this is what you see. That there can be a relatively large variation. And perhaps it's, you might say, well, this is under some control, but I don't really know how much control I can have as I vary the regulator. It's a question perhaps of imagination. So this is what I meant by being somewhat destructive, that there might not be an arbitrarily precise regulator independent statement that one can make. So that, and well, okay, let me get to that in the last slide. So maybe I just talk about this point here and not the others. Well, it is a question of calculating a bound, but beware. But I think more it's a question that there's a continuum limit we need to take, which is different from before, and it's one of communication. And I feel that it's perhaps the issue that triviality is a feature that the lattice is doing something wrong and it's our fault, where it's a feature of the theory. It's a property of its dynamics, and we're trying to be honest in exploring it. And whether the issue is ultimately going to be very important for the standard model is one thing, but whether for field theories beyond the standard model, the issue of triviality comes up again, it would be nice to have learned the lessons and to have explained them to others. All right, that's all. Thank you.
You did it in Sweden.
Okay.
Right. There's uncertainty in the speech. So when NF goes to infinity, you have no bubbles of your
the Higgs.
Scalar?
The Higgs, yeah, they're suppressed.
Okay, so that's a little bit worrisome. It's a bit artificial. You see, typically you don't expect, if you make one kind of fields, lots of them, and the other kind will sort of discriminate against and keep only one, the lesson may not be generalizable.
No, but okay, so the issue that you think that the variation with the regulator might seem stronger in this than in a real theory?
Yeah,
that is basically. That is possible.
I remember, but I don't remember where there's a problem, that this expansion, there were papers by Chernowitz and Applequist which on this path. I'm sorry, you remember paper by
No.
No, I don't know, but there is something fishy about this NF goes to infinity. Not fishy, I mean, I believe you. But physics, it may sort of miss if you give such an important job.
I just wanted to take one example where I could clearly see the dependence in the regulator, and that's just simply a message which has to be that message has to be also communicated, I think, and that's I think that's important.
The question is, it's just hard to believe. For me, it's hard to accept that this very continuum sort of argument does not never works.
What Rich was saying was that at some point, if you make the cutoff large enough, then the lattice calculation ought to agree with perturbation theory. It ought to show a crossover effect. You're saying that the lattice theory, the continuum limit of the lattice theory, takes into account triviality and the fact we've got fundamental scalars, is a trivial theory. The continuum theory that you naively want doesn't exist as a continuum limit of the lattice theory. You have a theory of fundamental scalars, you can't find any bare couplings which in the continuum limit will give you a non-trivial.
What Rich wants to have is have a very large cutoff, which is much higher than all of these properties such as instability appearing. And if that happens, then the lattice should show that happens.
We never have to take it to infinity.
No, but we know that the limit as the cutoff goes to infinity doesn't exist. And then it will have to break down at some point. The question is, does it break down before it goes negative or not? And what he's showing us is it breaks down basically just as it tries to go negative.
So that's the question. Can you separate the scale between the turnover and the cutoff?
Yeah.
What different all of the continuum perturbation theory do there? Because I think what you've shown were one loop plots, right? I would imagine.
Nope, the actual plot was a two loop plot.
Okay. I mean, the question is, does the continuum perturbation theory converge to the right of this vertical line? I would imagine it jumps.
Because the corrections are so large that it produces this difference from tree level?
Exactly. Then you're in large field fluctuations and that's non perturbative behavior.
Yeah,
so I would imagine perturbation theory to be reliable.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you take the perturbation theory out, then you settle this question. You just see whether it's converging or not.
Yes?
General question. So if you look at the integral at large pi for the Fermi's Higgs theories, is there any argument to show that the integral exists?
So if the Baire coupling for the Higgs is positive, the determinant essentially adds a logarithmic term to the effective potential. So it can never kill it. So the Baire coupling, the Baire coupling will always win at large phi. That's correct. But
so the only thing that it's, I mean, you can prove it usually that any instability is
What you're saying that it cannot be that the potential goes to minus infinity at large phi, and that's absolutely what I agree.
Nobody disagrees with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But can it go negative is the question.
Yeah.
Can it produce something like this for a while?
I mean, basically the statement is at the end of the day, there's no way to get a curve like that if the cutoff is much bigger than everything else. That's the statement.
Yeah, that's right.
To me, it sounds hard to believe because I see the mechanism in a very, just thinking about ordinary particles that make a curve like that.
And you say if the Higgs is light enough, the mechanism becomes more and more perturbated.
It seems totally unlikely.
It might be very hard to see in the lab.
I mean,
you have to get the cutoff.
It doesn't tell you that the whole scales which
No, I mean, your counter-argument are these RG equations.
Not only, also the potential itself. I can calculate that potential. I can tune myself to be very close to having a continuum-like theory. I can make the cutoff large. I didn't see this. This was not the best example to show. But that's a different question.
Absolutely, but I just want to see this, and it's hard for me to see that I can't get this line to go down,
Can you make the Higgs interaction large enough to actually keep the minimum?
No, it's all relative. I mean, it's just the two guys fighting with each other. Right?
Yes, but you can't make the renormalized lambda arbitrarily large.
But I don't know.
It's not the Fermions the problem, it's the Higgs, which is not letting you keep the first minimum in the place you want to come.
Could be, I don't know. It's counterintuitive for me.
Okay.
All right. In any way, is that important phenomenologically?
All right.
Now you ask.
What?
Now you ask.
Yes, right. So take that 120 from the optimal fit of the Higgs.
Mm-hmm.
That's here. That's that curve here. So now, one who has strong faith that this lower bound is correct might become somewhat pessimistic as that Higgs creeps ever slightly higher and seems to fit in nicely to this window. What I'm trying to say is that people should... One might become pessimistic and feel that there's no good reason for the standard model to break down at low energy scale if this is the correct lower bound. Because this curve here at 120 crosses in the order of between 100 and 1,000 TeV.
Yeah.
So if you're a big fan of this lower bound, then you might perhaps be a bit unhappy at the moment. I'm trying to say that there's no strong information we can take from such a lower bound.
No, nobody wants it more than 1 TeV. I mean, everybody expects something to happen around TV anyhow.
Then fine. Then, as I said, I'm trying to explain a fact.
Yeah.
Which is unnecessary. You asked the question if it's phenomenologically interesting.
Yes.
So if, for instance, if I had said that the Higgs is 400 or 500, then you would have said yes. Then that means that I cannot, if this was a correct...
I know that it's not. I know it's below 300.
Mm. Right, so now then these bounds become less interesting.
Well, if you say that the other way around, could you just say that if your Higgs is light, then the new something has to happen beyond the standard model at a scale which is less than the Planck length, the Planck mass.
If the bound is correct.
It's for length.
No, this bound. If the Higgs is observed and measured, and then we draw the horizontal line and intersect it with the lower bound, that tells us, we would say something. But if it's not a...
And it's 180 GV. It would be very hard to justify any other accelerators because we would have no reason to believe that there's any.
Perhaps I have not been strong enough. What I'm trying to say is what we should not believe about this curve. So I am not trying to necessarily even replace it. I'm just trying to give a feeling for how this might look in a given regulator, but would not be regulator independent. Now draw your own conclusions from that, what you will.
So you shouldn't make that stick claim that you just made.
What's the ground of the law?
You know, there's a similar claim being made. All the, which I don't understand, but I'll just review it. All of the high precision electroweak data is pushing the new physics higher than a TEV. And so all of the, these model builders, which I'm surrounded
right.
by, are all trying to figure out how to have the new physics go up another two or three orders of magnitude with little Higgses and loose diagrams and so on. So, I mean, that's consistent. You're saying that there might be no reason for new physics until considerably higher. You're saying that the standard model is already working much too well for new TEV physics. Because of precision electroweak,
does
not known the Higgs, just precision electroweak.
Well, precision electroweak with a Higgs, which is about 200.
Well, yeah, but I mean, without discovering the Higgs. I mean, some reasonable thing in there. And they're just saying it's working already too well, but this is the people who are pessimistic on SUSY by itself are saying that SUSY does not cure the problem of pushing the scale high enough, that you have to have SUSY plus some other mechanism.
But what you're saying, though, is that the vacuum instability bound from the continuum calculation is actually really sensitive to what new physics occurs at a large scale. So that's a bit of a cutoff. If you have new physics at 10 to the 12 GeV, then that vacuum instability bound is wrong. Because, I mean, that's effectively what we're saying is cutoff dependent.
Well, cutoff is just extra operators that throw in for some new physics. So you don't call it cutoff, just call it six-dimensional operator.
That's right. But that perturbative bound
is
removed by putting in just some new physics at a very large scale.
Okay. Thank you.